Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back here to the program David Desser. He's director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at the University of Illinois and teaches courses on world cinema and Asian cinema, which is something he's particularly interested in. And every once in a while, he's here on this program and we talk a little bit about movies. It's an opportunity to talk about how movies are made and a little bit about the history of film, and also to talk about some of the things that are now on theater screens around the country. It's also the opportunity for people who are listening to call in and tell us about movies that they have seen or ask questions. If there's something that you've seen that you thought was particularly good and you'd like to recommend it, you can do that. And if there's something that you've seen that you thought was particularly bad and you'd like to tell people to avoid it, you can do that. Anything that has to do with movies, you can give us a call. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Thanks for being here once again.
My pleasure as always.
So we're well into the summer movie season, the time when we expect to see a lot of big budget, special effects, action pictures that maybe don't have a lot on their minds, but maybe we don't care. And studios, I'm sure, are hoping that they will have something that'll be really big and they'll make a lot of money. And I expect the folks at Disney ought to be pretty happy.
Oh, I don't really know if that's true.
No? You doubt that?
No, they're not pretty happy. They're ecstatic.
Oh, they're ecstatic. So they, Pirates of the Caribbean, had the biggest opening in the history of Hollywood.
Indeed. And it was a tremendous success, despite some reviews were positive, some were negative, but some movies are, as they say, critic-proof, and I think that's one of them. Actually, I'll be curious. There is a – it's not yet known if there's – and once when it opened so big, somebody was talking about would it do worldwide Titanic numbers, literally Titanic as well as Titanic, which is, of course, $1.1 billion in worldwide grosses. I don't think that it will, but they're hoping that it'll do, as maybe second place of all time. Which is good because they've got another one coming out next year. They still have to make a 4,000. You know, I was just thinking that when they open up a movie really, really wide in the U.S. now, it's getting up to be 3,800 screens. Superman Returns opened on 3,800 screens, which means 3,800 copies. But I'm thinking now a lot of things are opening day and date worldwide. So I wonder how many prints are they making? And if you think about a 35 millimeter widescreen, Dolby track movie cost about $15,000 per print. There's a lot of money just making copies. Not to mention the people are pirating copies, but that's another story.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting thing to think about. But in any case, these box office numbers are just becoming unbelievable with counting foreign grosses. You just don't know how a movie is going to do. And but Pirates of the Caribbean, I don't know if it'll do. I guess the key will be if it does $400 million in the U.S. I've only been about four or five movies that have done that much, so we'll have to see if it does that much. I'm personally not confident that it will, but it's already done really well.
Yeah. Well, this gets at a question that I thought we might talk about a little bit, or at least I was interested in hearing what you have to say. And you touched on it when you talked about the fact that there may be some movies that are critic-proof, that it doesn't matter what reviewers say.
Mm-hmm.
But it is true that I think the reviews for this particular movie had been sort of mixed and not real great.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was thinking about this. There was A.O. Scott wrote a piece that it was in the New York Times, I think just today, actually, noting the fact that this particular movie made a lot of money. A lot of people went to see it, even though the reviews were sort of lukewarm. And he writes here, "For the second time this summer, then, my colleagues and I must face a frequently and not always politely asked question, what is wrong with you people?"
Mm.
says A.O. Scott. I guess the question is, Do reviews really matter?
I'll give you another example of a movie that was universally well-reviewed, and nobody's talking about how its box office is at best okay. And that is Flight 93, the 9/11 movie about the people who, you know, rebelled on the plane and crashed it in Pennsylvania. My memory was that it was nearing $40 million in box office, but I'm not sure it made it. Now, that's hardly very much for a movie. Now, of course, it was no star. It wasn't a big budget, but it had to cost $25 million, $30 million. I mean, they all do, unless it's, you know, an independent movie. So they all do. So here's a movie that's really not in profit, but there wasn't, to my memory, a single negative review, and everyone was, and they, you know, they even used a strategy for the marketing of interviewing, you know, average people. What did you think? You know, just something to get people to see that movie. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is basically with those numbers, most people weren't interested. I mean, more people saw, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean in the first show than saw the Flight 93. So that's, you know, a way of putting it into perspective. And that was a movie that was critically total, you know, absolutely loved. So if critics can't make a movie, they often can't break a movie. Now, the where critics do matter is still in that realm of the independent or foreign film that opens New York and needs the New York and national critics, which will inspire, say, the local art theater to pick it up. But the other thing is that if critics don't matter, the other thing that has happened is the world of criticism of reviewing has changed to the point where the internet, where anybody who wants to can post, so that there's a lot of chatter about movies both before, you know, in production, soon as it comes out. I was looking, you know, on the Internet Movie Database today about upcoming movies, and there's already comments about movies that people haven't seen yet. And so it's, you know, this is worldwide. And, you know, I spent a couple of years in working in Hollywood. And what I realized there was that everybody had an opinion about movies as they were being made. And a lot of it had to do with professional jealousy or, you know, talking up. So it's a company town. But now the whole world through the internet has the same kind of interest that was once confined to Hollywood. So the world of reviewing, the world of who will you listen to, I think has changed so much. And, of course, the greatest example is a movie that was changed even before it was finished, but was already the most exciting movie on, you know, in years, and that's the all-important and popular Snakes on a Plane. You know, which is a movie that's already in profit because everyone in the world is going to go, you know, you can buy merchandise for it already. So I think that for mainstream movies, the big budget movies are basically critic proof, but they're not word of mouth proof. So the biggest disappointment, I would say, for the summer for an average okay movie is Mission Impossible 3. And that, I think, was a combination of okay reviews, word of mouth, fallout about Tom Cruise's antics. So I think that there's a wider kind of audience for a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. And, of course, some movies, you know, have make or break on the quality of the film. So Poseidon was a flop because it's not very good. On the other hand, the Pirates of the Caribbean is not very good. It's okay, but it's a huge hit. So, but I do think that a lot of movies are critic-proof, and especially in the summertime. But what it does matter to, I think, is the egos of the people involved and the studio and publicity. And nobody likes to get a bad review.
Yeah. Well, we got some people to talk with. Why don't we do that? Our guest here is Dave Desser. He's professor and director of cinema studies at University of Illinois, and occasionally he's here, and we talk about movies and whatever's on your mind. You can call us. We have somebody here on a cell phone from Crescent City. They're the first in line. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Another interesting program. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Since I'm on the cell, and I don't want to break.
Oops. You're kind of breaking up on us. Okay. Well, I'm sorry. That caller can try again. Maybe it's just he was in a bad spot for the phone. Let's try Terre Haute, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I was wondering about Michael Moore's latest documentary he's putting together about healthcare in the United States. Do you know anything new on that?
No, I don't. I don't know anything new on that.
And actually, maybe I'm behind. This is sort of news to me that this is what his current project is.
Yes, it's on his website, and he said that a month or so ago, he said that it's taken a little different direction than he thought it was going to go, but he said that's typical for his work. And it's supposed to be out sometime in 2007.
Oh, so that's,
but that's, yeah. I guess... No. I know more about it than anybody else.
I think,
you and Michael, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you. And let's just go ahead to line number two. This is Urbana. Hello. So caller there, line two in Urbana.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could talk about the inconvenient truth written by Al Gore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. This here, you know, it's interesting that this follows somebody asking the question about Michael Moore, mm-hmm. because this is a kind of movie that we're starting to see more of in more their documentaries, their advocacy pieces that definitely have very strong points of view. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see these things in a more wide release, in theatrical release, where in the past I couldn't think of when you would, you know, before Hoop Dreams, maybe that was the big documentary that was a theatrical success.
Oh, yes.
You didn't see documentaries in movie theaters.
No, you did years ago. You know, the Academy Awards have been giving, you know, Best Feature Documentary for years. And you did years ago. I'm thinking of Harlan County, USA was a big one. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking Hearts and Minds in the Vietnam War. And these also were advocacy documentaries. And of course, you know, I think that most documentaries are, excuse me, do have a point of view. It's just that sometimes if the point of view is controversial, we may pay more attention. Mm-hmm. But every documentary has, is shaped by some kind of sensibility and has to have a point of view. It's just they don't all have to be, you know, political, such as, you know, the Spelling Bee documentary or the Winged Migration documentary. That Penguin documentary was pretty controversial. Politics were repressed.
That's right, because that's Hollywood doesn't appreciate solid family values.
That's true. Actually, someone did talk about that one of the reasons that film was popular, that it was because it was pro-family values. So that was kind of interesting. I thought it was popular because it looked like it was cold, and it was nice to see that. But I think you're right, and this has been a phenomenon of the last few years, and I've said that in some ways, first, that American independent films to some extent replaced foreign films in art theaters, and then documentaries to some extent have replaced independent films in art theaters. But I think that one of the things that Hollywood doesn't quite understand as well as they should is that there's an audience of a reasonable size for serious films. And that if you're not going to get your serious films in fiction, you're going to get it in documentary. Second of all, I think that Hollywood every so often remembers that many moviegoers are over at least the chronological age of 25. And that, again, if you're not going to appeal to, adults with serious content, you're going to get these independent films. And I think independent films have really become lower-budget Hollywood movies, even if they're quirky or edgy or whatever, mm-hmm. that there's still a kind of youth market that they have in mind. You know, like, you know, I thought it was good, but Napoleon Dynamite is not exactly a film that people over 50 are necessarily going to embrace. So I think these documentaries really fill a niche, and it's that adult, serious as well as the fact that, you know, these issues are very serious. I think people are quite well informed that, you know, they do have their advocacy and they can be seen as controversial. But a film like An Inconvenient Truth, I think, maybe is more effective than, say, some of Michael Moore's films because he's so intrusive in his own work that, you know, they become about him instead of about the issue. I do think now, of course, the box office for these things is respectable. But once again, if An Inconvenient Truth has done an incredible $5 million, again, Pirates of the Caribbean has done that in its first hour. So it's all relative, but it's a good and interesting phenomenon. But again, my theory is really that adults looking for serious, thoughtful, thought-provoking entertainment are not typically finding it in theatrical movies, and especially they're not finding it, you know, from April through September.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk with someone else in Charleston. This is line number one. Hello.
Well, hello.
Yes.
I just saw probably the best documentary, speaking of serious pieces for adults, that I've seen in probably years, probably a decade or so since I've seen one that was that good, and it's called Why We Fight.
Oh, yes.
Do you know anything about that?
Oh, yes. That's actually just come out on DVD.
Yes, I work at a movie store. That's how I got a hold of it.
Yeah, it had a decent theatrical run, and it had a very good critical response, and it's just come out on DVD, so we'll anticipate the usual what's do I recommend on DVD at the end of the show with that one. You know what I thought was interesting about Why We Fight was that it takes its title from the five series classics that Frank Capra directed for the Army in World War II.
Yeah, the propaganda pieces.
The propaganda pieces. And, right, to tell the home front and the soldiers why we fight. And so here you take that title, which I think is an interesting move, because it's a propaganda piece in a way that it's, you know, has a point of view. It's close in some ways without being as polemical as Hearts and Minds. I don't know if you remember that one from the 70s.
I haven't gotten a chance to see that one.
Yeah, that one, that was an interesting film at the time, but I think that's very intrusive in terms of trying to make comparisons. I remember even at the time, I was about 19 when it came out, and they make a lot of comparisons between the soldiers in Vietnam and high school football. And they want to talk about the kind of mindset that, you know, we would go to war because we have this kind of football mentality. Something like Why We Fight is a little more subtle than that, you know, the new one.
I also thought it was a very critical look at the last 45 years of a modern American history since, you know, Eisenhower's administration, that's where the film begins.
Right, right. No, I think it's very good, actually, and it's very, it's also been interesting because there have been a number of documentaries about the various wars. One of the most interesting, again, the title slips my mind, but it's one where a woman was going to make a documentary about fighting in Iraq, but she thought it would be much too dangerous and difficult to sort of be so embedded as to follow all these troops around. So she gave them, they gave troops cameras. If you can find that title, we'll all be grateful. But that's another very interesting thing. But with all of the wars, of course, in the last decade and obviously our history, there's just so many very good documentaries, such as The Fog of War.
That was very good, too. Yeah,
so I think that these are very thoughtful and thought-provoking and very serious. And it's so much easier these days to get a film made, to get a film shown, to get a film distributed, that you don't even have to, you know, one can talk about the democracy of the internet and all that. But between, you know, Sundance has the documentary thing, there's so many film festivals that are reacclaiming documentaries, word of mouth, ease of distribution on DVD, so many more art theaters. I mean, you know, many towns, you know, from Champaign and Bloomington Normal have these art theaters that in fact it's getting to be pretty good, and they really need a product that goes beyond, you know, Hollywood's drivel.
Well, Hollywood drivel, I understand all far too well working in a movie store.
Well, that's the A.O. Scott, question of what's wrong with these people. I'll give you, just not to get off the topic too much, but I'll have to use my prerogative here and say, what's wrong with these people? And that is a trailer that I keep seeing for the new Will Ferrell movie called Talladega Nights, The Legend of Ricky Bobby. And as far as I'm concerned, the only thing funny about that movie is the title, Ricky Bobby. Now, that's funny. But as I'm sitting in the theater watching the trailer, and there are people around me who are laughing, I want to turn around and say, what is wrong with you? This is not funny. This is stupid. And I'm a big fan of comedy, and they don't have to be subtle. They don't have to be the classic screwball comedies of the 30s. But, you know, a guy who thinks he's paralyzed and sticks himself in the thigh with a fork is just not that funny. So, you know, at some point, you might want to say, let's stop the drivel and let you know, there must be something we can do to see a serious, thoughtful movie that is also entertaining precisely because it's serious and thoughtful. You know, that's what makes a good documentary, is that it has a point of view, but it shapes its material in ways that allow you to appreciate, you know, what went into this. And, you know, good thought-provoking things are entertaining on their own, in their own right.
That's true. And one of the things that I truly enjoyed about this is that it at least attempted wholeheartedly to be a nonpartisan piece. It lambasted both sides of the aisles pretty equally.
Well, you know, at some point you just have to tell the truth, and both sides of the aisles are very responsible. But I don't mind partisanship if it's, as I say, all documentaries have a point of view, and documentaries can certainly be partisan. And so it's just how well they do it, and do they allow you the chance to, you know, to put your own thoughts into it. Do you get a chance to say, well, maybe, you know, so present material, shape material, but don't hit people over the head with it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think many of the things in Hollywood that come out would, the box office grosses would change drastically if people weren't willing to throw down $20 for a movie ticket to go see a piece of dreck. So.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, sometimes, as A.O. Scott says, you wonder, you know, what is going on sometimes. But, you know, where Hollywood drops the ball is not is not in these gigantic budget empty movies. It's in the fact that they're not giving people enough middle budget quality movies, that they really, you know, they keep turning out these gigantic movies. And you can see it this summer where, you know, that the trend toward comic book movies has been clear. But now there's just so many that, you know, even if you were a fan of the good ones, you might say enough is enough. How many times can I see an adaptation of a comic book, good or not good? And so I think that Hollywood really is, you know, and, you know, when Superman Returns cost $200 million, it's just getting a little carried away. So we want that crisp, small $50 million movie. Where's the low-budget sensibility? So I just think Hollywood is playing a
low budget.
Yeah, no, it's a sad state of affairs where that middle budget movie is really what gets pushed out. You can make a lot of money, you know, relatively speaking, with a small movie, and you can make a whole lot of money, relatively speaking, with a big budget movie. But that, you know, $25 to $50 million budget movie is difficult to pull off. And I think that Hollywood is going for the gigantic movie more and more. You know, well, it's always sad to talk about movies in the summer, though, because that's all you're going to see.
That's true. Well, thank you much. You have a nice day, Joe.
Thanks for the call. Let's continue. We'll talk to someone here on our toll-free line in Piatt County, line 4. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
One of the things I wanted to mention is I just agree so much with you, and I wanted to say also I think I'm an average person, and I mistakenly did not read any reviews of Pirates of the Caribbean. And I went to see it, and I just found it, I mean, nobody was laughing, and it wasn't, I found the special effects of Davy Jones' ship to be so stupid. I mean, it just, it was like a kind of a Star Wars, you know, some of those heads look like from Star Wars, and I thought this, it just was so bad, and I thought, did I miss something, because I like Johnny Depp, and I've seen Johnny Depp in several films, but then the plot element as an English major, when he's suddenly king of the island.
Yes.
Like, where did that plot come from? And was that to show there was nothing laughable about the natives? And
No.
And I thought, boy, I really missed so many.
Did you see the first one?
It had such a, yes, I did.
And you liked it better?
A little better. Oh. And so I should have been warned, shouldn't I?
Well, no, I think a lot of people, myself included, liked the first one quite a bit better. One reason is I think that Johnny Depp actually doesn't do that much in this one.
Yes, right.
And I actually like all of, you know, Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley. Everybody was kind of fine, but I thought the movie was plodding.
Yeah.
It really wasn't, you know, the word has to be engaging. And I think a lot of what's happening this summer – is an odd phenomenon, is in that is movies that should be about an hour and 45 minutes are 2:10 to 2:20. It's very difficult, actually, for movies without large-budget Bollywood-style musical numbers to be over 2 hours.
Yeah.
So it's kind of boring at some places. I actually found Superman Returns to be remarkably boring. When it wasn't boring, I thought it was silly. So Pirates of the Caribbean, you expect to be silly.
Yes.
But silly can be entertaining. But I think they really lost the human element.
Yeah.
But it also suffers from the not to give too much away, but it suffers from middle part of the trilogy syndrome.
Right.
And only Star Wars Episode V, The Empire Strikes Back, generally considered the best of the 6 Star Wars movie, although I think the first one, the Star Wars in 77, I think is the best. But a lot of people like The Empire Strikes Back the best, and that would be the exception to the middle trilogy. But this one really, Pirates of the Caribbean, really suffers from that. It doesn't even end, obviously. Like, to be continued next week. But it's not next week. It's next May. But we can wait.
I was also going to recommend for people who wanted to see a serious film that I thought was very moving was Water at the Art.
Oh, yes.
I wasn't aware of the situation or anything about that in India, and so I just would recommend that to anybody who wanted to see a serious, moving film.
Yeah. She has a trilogy, a kind of the elemental trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Earth, fire, and water.
Yeah. And I think fire is probably the best.
Okay, I haven't seen that yet, but I'm certain.
And I think earth is the weakest.
Yeah, okay.
But that's true. That's a very nice, that's a very serious movie indeed.
Yeah, right.
But that's definitely a grown-up movie.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you so much for this chance to express myself.
Sure. Other people who are listening are also welcome to express themselves. If you have a movie that you would like to recommend, that would be great. If you have a movie that you've seen you thought was terrible and you'd like to tell other people don't waste their money, you can do that. And other kinds of questions about movies are welcome, too. And our guest is David Desser. He's professor and director of cinema studies at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while, he's here on the program. We talk about movies. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I've been thinking about this very subject, and I guess one of the things that got me thinking about it was that I have been reading some reviews of a new book. It's actually a business book that has just recently come out that's getting some positive attention. It was written by a guy who was an editor at Wired, the magazine where they write about high tech.
Right.
And this is the title of this book is The Long Tail. And
right.
The subtitle is Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More. And
yes.
Essentially it's about niche.
Mm-hmm.
Niche marketing, and about the idea that, in fact, that we're moving more and more to this point where the idea, sort of the Hollywood idea, that you make one huge movie and you sell a bazillion tickets, we're going from that to the idea that whatever it is you provide, you can actually make money by selling a small number of units, but having a very diverse kind of inventory.
Yeah.
So if you have enough different things in your inventory, you can, and if you sell 5 of each one, you can still make money. The thing that I was thinking of is that completely argues against or goes in the opposite direction from Hollywood, where the studio seems like what you want is you're looking for the next Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody, now there's so much attention to opening weekends and stuff. Everybody is now going to try to make the movie that's going to set the new record for the biggest opening in history. That is completely going in the other direction. So I guess the question is, you know, is there any, do you think there's any possibility in Hollywood that kind of trend toward maybe making more different kinds of movies so that various kinds of people who are looking for particular kinds of movies can find that movie? Is that something we're actually going to see?
I don't think so. The thing about the Wired story, which I also heard, and I had read something about along those lines also earlier, I think it was in Time, was the notion of if you're the individual and you are the producer and you sell 5 units every year, you yourself won't make that much money.
Yeah.
So I think Hollywood's model is that the problem with the Hollywood model now is that they're pushing out other kinds of movies. If you go back to the days when the studios made a lot of movies, a couple a week, in that sense, they were more diverse, even though the only business they were in was movie making. right? The studios in the 30s and 40s didn't own record companies. They didn't own
no publishers.
They weren't. They didn't own publishers. They didn't also didn't
internet,
have ancillary
cable,
marketing.
Okay,
yeah, they didn't, right. So they didn't own parking lots, and so it was a different thing. But they made movies for a range of people, and no pressure was on necessarily any individual movie. Although obviously, you know, if a Gone with the Wind is a failure, it's a big deal. But at least you know that wasn't going to be all of your cash flow for 3 months. So I don't see how Hollywood can take that particular model. Unless they themselves get into, distribution of these little things. But I don't think that's going to happen. But we'll see. We'll see. I'm not a businessman. So if I were, I wouldn't invest in movies either. I'll tell you that. But I did find that particularly interesting about the long tail, because it also has to do with other hit-driven industries, which also includes, the wonderful world of book publishing, which is no less hit-driven and genre-driven than movies.
Yeah, and music business, too.
Well, there's the business that's really crazy, where if you want to start up a business, let me recommend you not open up a record store. Because everybody under 25 is downloading. Mm-hmm. And so many things that were fun when we were young, like last week, of going into a CD store and going around. That's also why your Walmart and your Best Buy can't afford to stock these things, because they take that model of, they have a lot of things for sale. But if you just have CDs, you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. We have several callers here, and we'll get right back to folks who are listening. We'll start. We have a couple of people here locally in Champaign, and we'll start with line one right here. Line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just going to actually follow up the point I was going to make on the publishing industry. If you look at the New York Times bestseller list recently, it's chock full of biographies and historical nonfiction, which I was curious whether that might kind of suggest a trend that Hollywood might be picking up on towards that sort of picture for the baby boom generation, who admittedly read more than they probably go to the films, but there might be an appetite there for things that are similar to what they're interested in reading.
That's an interesting point. I think you're probably right. Of course, we'd have to, as the scholar, you always want to sort of prove your case. We'd have to research what were the leading nonfiction bestsellers of, say, a previous period. And, of course, right, one of the other kind of nonfiction bestsellers is always self-help books.
Right.
But I bet that there's a relationship between Hollywood's also sudden interest in biopics. Seems like every, the Johnny Cash one was very popular, and the Ray Charles one was very popular, and the Bobby Darin one was not so popular, but it was good. And so that is a genre that suddenly reappeared, and it may have to do with the idea that baby boomers do tend to read, especially men,
right,
do tend to read nonfiction. And but history, of course, has always been a popular sort of, obviously nonfiction.
Right.
But I think there may be a kind of interrelationship between what you see in the movies and what you get. But I was thinking you were going to talk about the fiction bestseller list, which is really dominated, I think, much more than usual by non-literary fiction.
Right.
Right. You've got Janet Ivanovich as number one, and then Laurel Hamilton at number two, and Danielle Steele. I mean, these are, there's usually, except for John Updike, I don't think there's any literary fiction in the top 10 bestsellers on the New York Times as we speak. And it seems to me that the kind of authors that used to be paperback originals are showing up now not only in hardcover, but in hardcover bestsellers. And so there's kind of a dumbing down both in movies and in, I think, in fiction.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And just one more comment about the kind of the mid-sized Hollywood picture. Prairie Home Companion might qualify as...
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. And that's by, old-timer Robert Altman.
Right.
Exactly. Really, I think you're right. And what's interesting about that is that it opened a few weeks ago, closed, and came back.
Right.
Did you notice that? And I think it's because that a lot of the big movies aren't doing as well as they thought, so that there's suddenly screen space, of space mm-hmm. available, and that maybe they thought as the summer winds down a little bit, that a Prairie Home Companion. But the sad thing would be there's a movie that pretty much everybody loved that's chock full of all kinds of entertainment. But I think just like the documentary mm-hmm. about Will Shortz, the wordplay.
Yeah, right. About the crossword, crossword puzzle.
I think that the NPR audience isn't so huge. So Prairie Home Companion and Wordplay, the documentary, are going to do fine for what they are. But again, you're not going to see. But I think you're right about that. But, you know, if a movie like Prairie Home Companion doesn't do especially well, I think you'll find it more difficult.
Right.
Than, I mean, to me, the surprise hit of the middle movie is The Devil Wears Prada. It's doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say that necessarily a serious, thoughtful movie.
No.
But it is a moderate budget, and it is doing quite well. So there's always a little bit of hope, unless Hollywood misinterprets it and thinks it's, oh, a movie is about fashion.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's talk again with someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Ebertfest in April, and I saw a marvelous independent film called Man Push Cart.
Nice.
And, of course, I've talked about it to everybody, and I loved it and wanted to share it with people, and I can't find it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Can you suggest places that I could look to maybe get it on DVD, or has it not been released?
To my knowledge, it has not been released. That I think that Ebert's connections got him before it's even had a theatrical release. And so the easiest thing you can do, of course, is just do an internet search and just type in Man Push Cart DVD on Google.
I've done that. It's not anywhere.
Then it's not out yet. I suspect that it will show up eventually, but sometimes these things take time. That not everything shows up, but that one would. I mean, Ebert over the years has shown a lot of very interesting small movies that have never been released on DVD. Man Push Cart, I think, is at least big enough that it will show up eventually, but since it's yet to have any kind of wide, you know, by art standards release, it may be that they're hoping for some theatrical release.
And I wanted to say that I'm glad to hear that you thought Superman Returns was boring, because I did as well.
Oh,
and everybody
yeah.
I went with loved it. And I was like, how can you love this? This is not Superman.
Well, the beauty of movies is everybody has an opinion that's legitimate, but really I did think it was boring. And, you know, it's not necessarily the most highfalutin opinion. It missed the semiotic intelligence. But normally I would say a movie was boring.
It was very boring. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Our guest here this morning is the eminent film scholar, David Desser, who is, after all, ladies and gentlemen, he is director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at the University of Illinois and professor, and is occasionally here on the program when we talk about movies. He actually has done a lot of scholarly work, folks.
Indeed.
I don't want to make fun of that, because he has written a lot on film. He's written a lot on Asian film. He's particularly interested in Chinese film and Japanese film, and has, I think, in recent years become increasingly interested in Indian film. Has taught courses on those things, has taught on world cinema, and we're pleased to have him here every once in a while, and we always have a good time when he's here talking about movies. And you can do that, too, if you want to tell us about a movie that you have seen or ask questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Decatur is the next caller, line number three.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Good morning.
Professor, I was wondering if you could maybe explain the process how a film that gets a very, very limited release, how it can achieve a wide release. And my example would be A Scanner Darkly.
Well, it depends. There are different ways of distribution. Generally, you can open a movie in a limited release, but you always have the intention of opening it wider. So it depends on the studio. The other thing is that a movie, I think the best example is My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which really had, you know, super word of mouth. And the more popular it got in the theaters in which it played, the more theaters it eventually found. But if you're talking about Scanner Darkly, you're talking about a movie that always had in mind a certain number of theaters to begin with, because the summer season is very packed. So
okay.
you can't have a movie that, say, opens 2 weeks ago in New York and Los Angeles and Toronto and does really well, and then suddenly slot it into, say, 400 or 500 more screens. It has to be done. But if a movie opens in, say, 200 screens and does really well, then maybe a month later they can find the screens, book the screens, make the prints, and get it out. So, but for a movie that's come out in the summer, they always had in mind I don't quite know what to call it. I mean, it's not a super wide release, but it's a reasonably wide release. Anything, I think, more than about, say, 800 prints, which I bet Scanner Darkly has, is a movie that always had that in mind. You can't just find theaters quickly.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. And we'll go on again to someone here, let me see, in Belgium, over by Danville, line 4. Hello.
Good morning, sirs.
Mm-hmm.
I just had to call and make a comment on a comment your guest just made a few minutes ago about record stores.
Yes.
Where I have to agree that opening a new record store is probably not a good idea. I have a very, very, very close friend who has a record store, and where he no longer has the situation that he used to have where he made a lot of money, what he has now is rarity. He's the only record store around.
Ah.
And now he also is involved on the Internet,
yes,
which makes him a lot of money. So maybe when a technology dies or something is causing problems, you need to just take a different view of it to make money from it.
Yes, the entrepreneurial spirit, yes, is very important. Yes. I agree 100%. You know, what happened, you know, again, was that the places like a Walmart and Target and Best Buy that all sell so many CDs, but also other things, it becomes difficult for the standalone store to survive unless they are either going to be, you know, unique, patronized by specialty audiences. One in Urbana that sells new and used.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one in Champaign as well.
Yeah.
And so it's possibly to make a living, but again, it's just one of those things that, as you correctly say, you know, when technology shifts, the entrepreneur needs to go with the flow, or they'll, you know. You know, one of the things that's funny was when I was a kid, the department store and the supermarket. Well, department stores weren't new. I shouldn't say that when I was a kid. I wasn't born in the 1840s. But the department store was expanding, and the supermarket actually was fairly new. And they were beginning to put individual specialty shops out of business. Years later, a lot of department stores went under or were consolidated because specialty shops came along to, you know, to compete. So, you know, the so-called boutique or the, you know, the specialty wine shops. So there are niches that do exist. It's just when, you know, as we've just been talking about, you know, sort of mainstream Hollywood movies or mainstream publishing, by definition, mainstream is really going to be going for large, you know, vast audiences worldwide. And so it's just a different way of operating. You know, when I was a kid, I loved the record shops. It's almost like libraries, wouldn't you, in some way, or bookstores. Wouldn't you rather go to a library or a bookstore to browse than browse Amazon? So for that person, there's a low-tech approach.
Yes. An example of what you're talking about is Sam Goody, is that it? Larger record store that is essentially going out of business because,
yes,
of the lack of thing. However, they have a much larger overhead and much harder to run a huge organization like that than it is a small situation like you have there in Urbana-Champaign. There's one over here in Danville.
You find them
very infrequently, but there are record stores around.
No, it's true, and it's funny about that. The Sam Goody or Tower is another chain that's perpetually in financial troubles, that these kind of middle chains like Sam Goody, which was a chain when I was a kid, so I mean it had been around a while, but these Tower and Sam Goodies are going under because they're too big to find that niche, but not big enough to compete with, you know, Walmart is the biggest seller of CDs in the country.
Yeah, and that's a real problem because Walmart can sell a CD for less than my very close friend can even buy.
Well, that's the other problem. That's right. That's the other problem. It's the same thing with Walmart's ability in the supermarket.
Yeah.
If you can just buy cheaper, you know, or you can sell a million things for a dollar more than you paid for it. But if you're going to sell 10 things for a dollar more than you paid for it, you're going to be in trouble.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks. You know, Walmart is also the largest seller of diamonds in the United States.
I did not know that.
I think they're about the largest seller of everything in the United States.
No, I did read about Walmart getting into the organic food market, and they'll soon be the largest seller of organic food. So it's just Walmart.
Well, it's interesting. It goes back to where we were talking before about the long tail and idea. I wonder if that really does argue for a different kind of distribution, and then, in fact, maybe you still can make money selling books or selling records or whatever. But as a brick-and-mortar store, I don't know if there's some point at which you can't make it go, and that then you have to go for essentially selling through the web.
Yes. Yeah, well, I'm going to use the example of the bookstore that used to be in Champaign called Babbitt's. When their rent got too high in their weird location above ground, they moved out of Champaign, and they have a store in Bloomington, Normal. Actually, it's in Normal. But the Normal store is very uninteresting because Babbitt's is now making most of their money, and they made a lot of it when they were in Champaign, by selling over the internet. Obviously, they're not competing with, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, but their brick-and-mortar store in Normal is nothing like their one in Champaign, but they couldn't afford the one in Champaign, but they're doing fine as an internet provider. And there was just an article in the Tribune about a few days ago about some of these, I don't know what you'd call them, stores, the collectible-type stores that are just going out of business, and a lot of them, you know, saying, well, we'll sell on the web, we'll sell on eBay. You know, in a way, eBay became, you know, your collectible kind of store. Yeah. So that kooky store that sells, you know, lunch boxes from the 1950s and toys and things and all that, that's really, you know, that's a niche, but it's maybe easier filled on the internet instead of the high prices you'd have to pay in central Chicago.
Right. We have a couple of other callers. We'll see how many people we can get in. We have maybe 2-3 minutes left. Next is Champagne in line one. Hello.
Line one?
Yes.
Yes. I'm just wondering about a film that there was a wonderful review of, and I don't think I ever saw it in the theaters here in Champaign-Urbana, Heart of the Game. Although I don't really care much about basketball, it's the story of a documentary of Seattle high school basketball team and of a young woman.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It's
out now.
So whatever happened? It's where?
It's currently playing now. I mean, not in Champaign-Urbana, but it's making the rounds now.
Oh, I see. So it
so it's quite, it's
here.
Really quite new, and that'll definitely show up on DVD before too long. But I think it's so new that if Champaign-Urbana Art Theater gets it, it may or may not. But it's not like it's so old that, you know, it's hopeless.
Oh, that's very encouraging. Okay, so this must be one of the long run things. I think I first saw the review maybe a couple of months ago.
Yeah, but that, you know, for documentaries, that's you know, it makes the round for 4 or 5 months. And Inconvenient Truth has been out for quite a few months already. So,
yeah.
And of course, in Champaign-Urbana, it takes a little longer to come to our art because of the nature of distribution. They only make a few prints, and we're low on the hierarchy. But, you know, it might very well be playing in Chicago, for instance. But I think that'll definitely be a DVD movie in any case. But, again, it's fairly new.
All right.
That's very good to hear. I'm glad it's just delayed instead of absent. So,
great.
Thanks.
Thank you. Let's talk with someone in Kankakee. This is line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
A question that maybe has been covered previously. I just came online with you in about 10 minutes ago. But I wanted to know if you would speak a little bit about the effect on the movie industry of file sharing and BitTorrent in particular on the internet as a way of accessing movies, especially for folks who live in rural areas who aren't going to see the kind of films that you've been talking a lot about today.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing there is someone has to figure out how to do it legally and how to make money on it. But I think that Hollywood is on the verge, or other distributors. A lot of the niche distributors will do that. And where it's really come up is in the post-broadcast distribution of television to downloading. And the future of some of these things may actually be hooked up into the technology that iPod relies on. So I think down the road you will find that the delivery system will be just as you say, but the key there is just as the music industry had to figure out how to make downloads legal and how to make them commercial. Once that happens for movies, which obviously take a whole lot more bandwidth to do, but it'll happen. It'll definitely happen.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. And let's talk with Danville, line three. Hello.
Yes, that's me.
Yes.
I was going to say, you mentioned something about The Devil Wears Prada, and I know several adolescent girls who are Project Runway fans, and that's, they don't know anything about the novel, but they heard the word Prada from Project Runway and decided to go see the movie, and my daughter really loved it and came home and said, you know, Meryl Streep, she's kind of old, but she's good.
Well, she is kind of old. So.
Yeah, I said, you don't even know how old she is. So I'm hoping that means we'll, this is a movie-going audience. I hope we see lots of Meryl Streep in years to come, even more than we've already seen her, because she is wonderful. But
she is, and she's always busy.
I don't think she's hurting for work, but
She's actually going to be doing.
She's also in the Prairie Home Companion.
She's also doing a play in New York. She's doing a Shakespeare. Oh. She's doing Shakespeare in New York, the Public Theater. So she's not hurting for work, but sometimes it's hard to see if you don't live in New York.
Yeah, well, we'll be renting more Meryl Streep movies as my daughter gets older. But a team that I've really come to respect and seek out their movies are Steven Soderbergh and George Clooney, because we saw Welcome to Collinwood just on a whim a couple of years ago, which just cracked me up. And then The Matador that came out recently with Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, yes.
Really liked that.
Good point. Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. You know, that was a very well-reviewed and well-received movie, but its box office was minimal, but I like the way he plays off his James Bond persona.
And I don't even remember hearing about that movie until last, week or two ago when I saw it, coming out on DVD.
I think its commercial profile was low, but again, maybe that's another example of critics liked it. Audiences didn't quite appreciate it so much.
So I would definitely recommend those. And then I also rented Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which I remember seeing in the theaters, seeing coming out. I didn't see it in the theaters. Mm-hmm. I saw it on DVD. And I like that, too.
I liked it a lot, too. But I would say that's a little bit specialized because it's so aware of itself as a movie.
Right.
But it's good.
I can see why it didn't, a big box office movie.
Definitely.
But I enjoyed it. I'd like to see more things like that. Definitely.
Yeah, no, I liked it too. I liked it too, actually.
So those were my recommendations.
All right. Well, thanks very much. Well, before we go here, the thing I always ask you to do at the end is if people just can't find anything in the theater, if they want to go down to the video store, would there be something that you might suggest?
Well, here I'm going to go with the motif of not Hollywood, and I'm going to go with reminding people that the Oscar winner for Best Foreign Film has just come out on DVD, Tsotsi, South African film. And then I'm also going to recommend a movie that's been on DVD, but the DVD was no good. And now there's a good quality DVD, and that's the lengthy Edward Yang film Yi Yi, also called A One and a Two, which I really think, all the movies released by Criterion are, technically unbelievable. And all the reviews have been, the first DVD release was bad, now it's good. But I think people forgot to mention that Yi Yi is a very good movie. It's very entertaining. So Tsotsi and Yi Yi are my recommendations.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Desser, professor of cinema studies here at the University of Illinois.